Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. The war in Gaza has changed the Middle East. In the short run for the worse, maybe, just maybe, in the long run for something better. Sometimes failure and disaster become the mother of new possibilities. However, given what is happening day after day to Palestinians on the ground, it is very hard to sustain any optimism about the next chapter, whatever it might be. If nothing else, the brutality of October 7th and of the continuing Israeli assault on Gaza have brought the issue of Palestine and Palestinians back to the surface. It's been years since, quote, peace in the Middle East, unquote, actually referred to them and the Israelis rather than to Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and seemingly endless other conflicts in the region. Does that mean that a serious negotiation of the contours of a Palestinian state may become possible? Spanish Prime Minister Sanchez insists his country will soon recognize Palestine. President Biden talks about reviving a negotiation for the elusive two-state solution. The Saudis have publicly said they will not open diplomatic relations with Israel unless an independent Palestinian state is recognized on 1967 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital. All of that amounts, I hope, to a thin hint of optimism amidst the carnage. For insight into what is really possible, I turn today to Nabil Fahmy, longtime Egyptian diplomat and former foreign minister, who has more real-time experience dealing with these issues than perhaps anyone else around today. Welcome, Nabil, to New Thinking for a New World.
Thank you very much, Alan. It's always great to be with you, although this is a very difficult topic, both in terms of the substance and in terms of the level of inhumanity that we're seeing in the last couple of months.
Absolutely. Let me start by saying, I think, as you know, that my plan had been to have this conversation weeks ago, but I was hoping, I confess, actually expecting that a ceasefire would be a better context for discussion of diplomacy and solutions, but still no ceasefire. Ramadan has come and gone, and the fighting continues. Is diplomacy even possible?
It's a great question. My response is, it's the only option we have if we want to stop this cycle of violence. And let me add to it, while ultimately the regional players, those on the ground, Palestinians and Israelis in particular, but others in the region, will be the deciding players, we are in the Middle East today with the level of hatred back and forth, unable to pursue concrete, constructive diplomacy alone. This has to involve the main players, but also the international community, be that with all of my reservations regarding some American positions, be that the United States, which still is influential in the region, as well as the larger community, the United Nations, the European Union, and you mentioned, for example, Spain as one example. If this doesn't become a larger issue for the world, the politicians on the ground will be unable to take strong decisions or will not feel compelled to. So we will end up having not one ceasefire, a series of ceasefires, low-scale confrontation, and then a major confrontations every now and then. And my sense, my real concern here is if people lose hope and are taken out of the general context of state-to-state confrontation, you will end up with non-state parties using violence very, very frequently at horrendous cost to all of us concerned.
I'd like to talk about those various pieces, the various actors you described, the Israelis, the Palestinians, the rest of the Arabs, the Americans, the community, et cetera. And you did not mention China, but I will come back to China as potentially an actor. Let's start with the Israelis. If they have a vision, it seems to be the status quo ante, but that is to say, they've talked publicly about isolating Gaza, enclosing it in some kind of cordon sanitaire, no economic relationships, whatever happens in Gaza. No one is buying that or even willing to discuss it because it clearly does not meet any of the criteria you just suggested. But is anyone willing or able to tell the Israelis that that is not acceptable?
Well, again,
or is that not fair to the Israelis? Is there some other vision that I missed?
Sure. Let me put it this way. I understand the shock that the Israelis had on October 7th, although I wasn't surprised by October 7th, except in its magnitude, because the Palestinians have been under occupation for 75 years or more, and they have suffered both in terms of nationhood as well as on a personal basis. That being said, I want to move forward. Now, after what's happened to Israelis and to Palestinians, with 30,000 at least killed and 100,000 killed and injured, you can't deal with this incrementally. And let me give you a specific example. The Israelis don't agree to any step forward unless there is some sort of hostage exchange, partial or complete. They also have made the point that for them, they want to get rid of Hamas completely, don't accept anybody to have overall supervision of Gaza, especially in terms of security, except themselves. Now, who under the sun on the Palestinian side is going to agree to that? Will Hamas agree to a return of hostages if they have no future, don't have safe passage? That's not going to happen. Is there anybody under the sun in our region, but even beyond our region, ready to go in there and preserve security with the proviso that Israel always has the right to intervene if it feels threatened? That's not going to happen either. Therefore, we actually need to look more deeply into this and make the package wider and deeper. In other words, I accept that there has to be a ceasefire. I accept that there has to be a hostage exchange. But I can't sell these two things without dealing with the core issue, which is what happened on October 7th and what happened 75 years ago. That may be difficult, but it's the only way forward. Otherwise, small steps will lead to regressions again. So my suggestion, frankly, is put forward a 10-point action plan that can be implemented within 24 months.
Let me just interrupt because I want to come to that in a second, but I first want to get the Palestinians in the room because, as you've already said, too often these negotiations are about the Palestinians, not with the Palestinians. And there's all sorts of historic reasons why that's the case. It's about leadership. It's about all sorts of things. But arguably, that is one of the reasons why this negotiation over time hasn't succeeded. And it's certainly, before we get to 10 points, without Palestinians, whatever that means, in the room, you can't do that. So talk just for a moment about how you understand the dynamic. Let me put it differently. Who are the Palestinians? The old Kissinger thing, who are the Europeans? Who am I going to call if I want to talk to the Europeans? Who am I going to call to talk to the Palestinians?
Again, as usual, you put forward a tremendously precise question. That is the issue. The world has been ignoring the fact that there are different trends in Palestinian circles. Some of them more angry than others. Some of them ready to use violence more than others. That's the reality, whether we like it or not. If you want to solve this, we have to deal with all of them. But I don't want to solve it in a way that raises one side versus the other. I want to solve it in a way that deals with the Palestinian issue so that we could move forward. And let me be precise here. Who are we as Egyptians and Qataris, and the U.S., by the way, but let me add to that, and the Israelis, negotiating with now for the release of hostages? With Hamas. Anybody who wants to deny that can, with all due respect, go fly a kite. We are being asked by the U.S. and by Israel to negotiate with Hamas. And both Israel and the U.S. is saying that we don't want Hamas to have a future. Well, how can you possibly do that? The only way to do that is to solve the whole problem so that it's not angry parties against each other. It's actually parties that, with tremendous pain, have moved forward. So I'm not interested, ultimately, in solving this for Bibi Netanyahu or for Hamas. I'm interested in solving this for Palestinians and Israelis. That's the only way forward. There's not going to be able to do it otherwise. Now, yes, Egyptians have been talking before October 7th with Hamas on border security, but with the PA on the politics of the region. Since there's no peace process, no possibility whatsoever with the present Israeli government to move forward, and with a number of others previously, a number of them previous to that, the PA has been basically out of the picture because there's no story to tell you. So what does that do? It raises the prominence of Hamas. So again, we cannot deal with this incrementally. We've gone the gap and the, if you want, the damage has gone too deep to come and say, okay, let's stitch it a little bit. It's not going to work. Unless you really want to highlight again the role of Hamas and the role of the extreme right in Israel, because those are the two who are calling the shots presently on the ground. Now, let me make one last point, and this is not in support of anybody in particular, but it's just for the sake of being candidly blunt, or if you want, brutally candid, I'm sorry.
Both are true.
The reality is, everybody's terrorist is somebody's freedom fighter. Now, that applies both sides. I can name Israeli prime ministers who were legally considered to be terrorists in Western Europe. I don't want to get into that, but the reality is they were fighting for something that I don't agree with. Hamas is fighting for something that clearly Israelis don't agree with. So I want to get over this idea of that's the terrorist. He's fighting for exactly the same thing you were fighting for in the past. And that's not even getting into the fact that Netanyahu was actually providing support for Hamas by his own recognition, not my own. Anyway, again, we need to move forward, and it is so complicated that the politics in the region alone is not enough. The world has to join us in saying, enough is enough. Enough killed is enough. Enough politics. It's now time to solve this.
Let's just talk, though, for a minute about the region. Clearly, over the last decade, two decades, there's been a shift in the center of gravity of power towards the Gulf, towards the Saudis and the Emiratis, for all sorts of reasons, in Syria, in Egypt, in Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. The Gulf states, especially the Saudis and the Emiratis, seem to behave as though they think they're the regional powers and that they then think they are critical to this effort to go forward. And you've got that wrapped up in the Abraham Accords and those relationships and headed off in a direction that seemed to forget about the Palestinians, which I would argue was one at least proximate cause of this tragedy. How do you think about the Gulf states today, as opposed to the role they played decades ago? I'd say it differently. The non-role they played decades ago in practical terms. Can they be part of a solution? I guess is where I'm going with that.
Definitely, I think they can be part of the solution. I think one, irrespective of one's opinion on the Abraham Accords in support or not in support of it, The reality is, and the point you started off with at the beginning, the Palestinian issue was dormant, or if at least not hot for a number of years. What was hot was Iraq, the Iranian situation, what's happening in Syria, a lot of things that are really in West Asia and in Southwest Asia, if you want. Therefore, it's natural that the Gulf states would become more active on those issues. You add to that that the Gulf states, not the Saudis, but the smaller Gulf states, have now had a longer lifespan. Therefore, they're now more engaged in a number of issues. So, yes, I see them more active, and therefore they are more of a player. Now, I don't really see that as on the Palestinian issue as diminishing the role of Egypt or Jordan, because there's a proximity issue here. But yes, there is an additional player. And I do believe that the Gulf states would support any agreement that Arabs, that Palestinians and Israelis reach together. But let me add to this, and I say this regrettably, frankly, I've been doing this for all of my career, that we haven't been able to solve this up to now. It hurts me personally. But I started off very candidly saying, we can't solve it alone. So I need your help as an international community. And of course, if I'm reaching out to you, then I'm also reaching out to everybody in the region. But the Gulf states, correctly, frankly, are quite annoyed by the fact that people think they're an ATM machine. What are they asked to do? Pay for the reconstruction of Gaza, that they weren't part of the destruction. What are they asked to do? Why don't you come and police Gaza with the Egyptians and possibly somebody else? Is that logical to be put in the middle of a battlefield between Palestinians and Israelis? So, yeah, they will have a role to play. We'll have to listen to their role. But that does not, frankly, for me at least, it's not a concern. It's an asset that we should take advantage of. The Gulf role with a significant action plan to solve the problem is important. The Gulf role in the absence of an action plan will appear to some to be detrimental because it doesn't focus on the Palestinian. But again, it's not a widespread brush to everybody.
Do you know leaders who, young or old, regardless of where they live or what they do, who are changing the world? Leaders who are not content with what is and are working hard for what could be? If so, please nominate them for the Telberg SNF Eliasson Global Leadership Prize at telbergprize.org. The nomination period will open on March 15th. Let's leave for a moment the Americans and the international community and focus on that action plan. What you introduced earlier the notion of not a process. We've had way too many processes. You're interested in the outcome. So you have thought very carefully. Share with us your vision.
The basic idea is make a predetermination from the very beginning and then apply reverse engineering. The commitment, and it has to be embraced by the international community. So the basic idea is a Security Council resolution positively supported by the 15 members calling for the following: ceasefire and the provision of humanitarian assistance, withdrawal, development of a security arrangement between Israelis and Palestinians to ensure non-use of force, the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza, international support for the reconstruction and the return of Palestinians. The very beginning of that, after the ceasefire, you'd have hostage exchanges and exchanges of those arrested in Israeli prisons from Palestinians. I'd add to that a number of things. So here you already have a number of things that are useful for Palestinians and for Israelis. But I would add to that recognition of Palestinian state based on 1967, under occupation. I'm not talking about recognition by Israel per se at this point, but if they want to, that would be helpful. I'm talking about international recognition, including their possible admission to the UN, although I'm more focused on the international recognition. Furthermore, another step would be a clear determination by the in that resolution calling for a Palestinian engagement to create a new government that deals both with Gaza and the West Bank, what we're calling a technocratic government. I would have, given the political difficulties on the ground for both sides, I would call for elections both in the, among Palestinians and Israelis in the next 12 months. And I conclude by a reaffirmation, well, 2 points, sorry. I conclude by reaffirmation of the Beirut summit declaration, which says openly that as there is a solution between Palestine and Israel, there will be normal relations between Israel and all the Arab states. And finally, there should be a clear determination in the Security Council resolution that the objective is to establish a two-state solution, living securely side by side within 24 months. Now, I know it's a difficult sell, but it's a, frankly, a much more logical sell than saying, give up all the hostages without a ceasefire, or give the ceasefire without the hostages. We will end up with ongoing hostility endlessly if we simply try to do one step, especially with the situation taken by the Israelis that even if that happens, we will go after Hamas leaders wherever they are.
You did not mention the word settlements, I suspect consciously, because clearly that is, has been, and at the rate we're going, would continue to be not a sticking point, but a destruction point.
That's why I said this has to be endorsed by the international community. The international community is openly on record saying that settlements are illegal. And when I'm talking about a two-state solution, I'm talking about a Palestinian state and an Israeli state, of course. But the Palestinian state involves both Gaza and the West Bank. Now, each one of these points, by the way, independently, has a huge amount of material adopted internationally that provides an annotated basis for the details of each one of these points. And if you take each one of them, every single one of them is accepted by all the members and the international community independently. The issue is, how do you balance it out and sequence it? But of course, settlements will be a problem. Violence on both sides will be a problem. But I didn't get into that level of detail because this is just simply the action plan. Now, in the Security Council, I would expect there to be more material reaffirming what should be done on both sides.
The obvious question is what you well know. As you said, there are elements for everything you said. There's elements already on the paperwork that have occurred over time that have been endorsed, discussed endlessly, usually individually, not collectively. And the virtue of what you've done is say, no, we got to do it all at once. It's a holistic, I hate the word, but it's appropriate here, a holistic approach. It's all or nothing. And you have seen what nothing produces. So you're on the all side. Frankly, the problem then becomes whether, and this is why I suspect you've emphasized the international community so much, including the Americans, Israel has clearly been unwilling, and elements of the Palestinians unwilling or unable to move on all of those things which have been around for decades. What's going to force the Israelis to accept that they have, that it is in their interest And if they don't see it as in their interest, that would force the Israelis to accept moving in this direction, which they've been unwilling to do so since the failure, the last big failure, which was years ago now.
I've said at the beginning that I wasn't particularly happy with positions taken by the administration regarding the Gaza thing from the very beginning.
The U.S. administration.
Yes, U.S. administration, exactly. And my position remains that I'm critical of that. But not only is Israel losing internationally and regionally, given the amount of violence in Gaza, the U.S. is as well. I can tell you, U.S. credibility, first of all, the double standards is just so flagrant. Secondly, the fact that you will stand for right and wrong is obviously not the case. Thirdly, even with the dialogue or the lack of dialogue, the diatribes between you and the Israelis, or at least between Biden and Netanyahu, you even appear to be ineffective. And your credibility is diminishing. And that will have implications for your security in the region, medium and long term. And it will even go beyond that, frankly, in how people look at you. So you are going to pay a price for this continuing. The Israelis also, after they get over their anger with what happened on October 7th, the reality is, if you don't deal with how do we stop this from happening again, the only way to stop this is to solve the problem. Because, and let me give you one anecdote. Look, violence breeds violence. The Prime Minister Rabin was not assassinated by a Palestinian. Assassinated by an Israeli, Anwar Sadat, who is considered by the international community as being the leader for peace, was assassinated by an Egyptian. So what concerns me is I don't want to fuel the cycle of violence and the justification of non-state parties to take this out of their head. I think, frankly, friends and wise neighbors need to speak truth to power. We need to provide some tough love. That you want this to continue. Let me add another point, if I may, Alan. I'm sorry to keep jumping back and forth. The U.S. is violating its own law, by the way. Openly. And I've worked on this when I was in Washington. The Leahy legislation does not allow for the use of American weapons against civilians. Now, you're trying to explain to me or anybody here that the weaponry Israel is being used is not attacking civilians, and that some certificate that you're going to get is enough. The consequences here is not that people look at Netanyahu or his present government as being bad. They look now at the U.S. as being bad. So you are going to pay a price for this. If you really want to have a role in the region, you want to counter Russian or Chinese or whatever influence, there has to be a point where you stand on principle. Now, there is a slight shift in U.S. rhetoric, but there isn't a shift in U.S. actions.
Let me jump in here because I want you to talk a little bit about a possibility that, in fact, the era of the U.S. caring in any substantial way about these issues, other than blah, blah rhetoric, has passed. That, in fact, the U.S. is no longer that concerned with its ability to influence or not influence, that we are now, I would argue, for 25 years in a process of withdrawal. And so everything you said, I happen to agree with, that if one was trying to either maximize or optimize American influence, one would be behaving very differently. And it's not just this administration, it's certainly its predecessor. And whatever administration comes next, it's either going to be the predecessor or this one coming next. So I don't see a world where we are, the United States, not we, where the United States is suddenly going to stand up and say, oh my God, I should have been doing something different. I really want to move this into a space and I'm going to use power to speak to power. Because I don't think the U.S. needs to speak truth to power, needs to use use power to speak to power. And I would like, what if the United States doesn't do that? Can you think about the world where that, unfortunate as it might be, is the case?
Yes. I actually think we're already there. You, and I say this, and you know my empathy for Americans as a people, despite my disenchantment with some of the policies. You, America, the American population, has moved from wanting to be a global power with the benefits and responsibilities to being a superpower, which basically means I'm stronger and richer than anybody else. And as long as I can have that influence without the responsibility, then I can move forward. That's really what made you move from engagement on many of these issues. It's not that you believe that peace in the Middle East helps you with your strategic competition internationally, because you don't feel that competition from the Russians, previously the Soviets, or the Chinese. It simply, is this worth it or not for you materially? And I say this, and again, President Obama said, I'm going to pivot towards China, and it's time for the Saudis and Iranians to solve their problems alone. And even though he tried to help initially on the Palestinian issue, he decided to give up on that and move forward. As a superpower, you can do that. As a global power, you cannot. That's my first point. So, and because of that, I love people accusing me of being an idealist. I regret to say I'm more of a pragmatist than an idealist, but I'm not. I'm saying the U.S. role, the U.S. has to be there. But I love the question. I don't believe the U.S. alone can help, because your new posture and your domestic politics, besides the issues you're going into election, all three of them, not only the election, makes you incapable of taking strategic decisions. So I want the U.S. there, but I want the Security Council there with all the permanent members. I want the U.N. there. I want the legitimacy of the U.N. there, so that when you in the U.S. talk to your own constituency, you are able to say, our friends in Europe, our friends in the Middle East, our friends in Asia, our credibility internationally requires that we take a more positive position. And frankly, I've been a proponent of higher regional proactive diplomacy. That being said, I don't think America will come up with the ultimate solution, because you're too calculative to do that. But that's why I'm coming up with these, for example, these 10 points, which I know are difficult to swallow. But ultimately, if I can get enough support, and you at the very beginning mentioned that the Spaniards are looking at possibly recognizing Palestinian state. Well, if I can get enough of that moving, can get enough people talking about a ceasefire. The French now have just signed a document with an article with President Sisi and King Abdullah of Jordan calling for a ceasefire. If you can get more of these pieces out there, it creates momentum to resonate with America, with Russians, with the Chinese, with Israelis, with the Palestinians, that this is becoming too expensive and too costly for all of us, and we need peace. The Middle East is being recalibrated. And if we recalibrate it into a mode where nation states don't have credibility or authority, where non-state parties can express their anger because we can't provide them with resolution to their concerns, it's going to be a very unstable situation.
Let me ask one last question. We've touched on it a couple times, and it's the potential or actual role of the Chinese. The Chinese are not a traditional power in the region. They've not been part of the history of the last 75 years. They have shown up Belt and Road on the economic side. They facilitated the Saudi-Iranian rapprochement. I suspect that they are in a pretty active listening mode at the moment, listening to what you've been saying, listening to what others are saying, could they play a role if the Americans are not as engaged as I think you elegantly described? Why? Is there space for the Chinese, although they lack any history? History matters in these matters.
It's if they want to be a major power, they don't, there isn't there's space. They have to create space for themselves. You cannot simply be a major economic power and not bear responsibility in stabilizing the world order per se. That's my first point. But secondly, to be fair to the Chinese, they're just starting off on this process. But they did do the Iranian-Saudi thing. And even before that, by the way, but people didn't take it seriously. About 5 years ago, just before COVID, they issued a statement from the foreign minister, who is now again the foreign minister, saying that we want peace and security in the Middle East based on dialogue and cooperation. So they actually started to talk about the politics of the Middle East almost 5 years ago. And I've known the foreign minister for years, and I was even surprised by why they sort of threw out that. But as your former friend, the late Dr. Kissinger, often mentioned, they always think strategy. So they're always thinking what's going to happen next. I actually believe that they understand they will have to be playing a more prominent role. If you look at, they actually have good relations with Israelis and with Arabs. They have interests both in terms of energy, military cooperation, logistic cooperation throughout the region. And for only way for them to safeguard all of those interests is to create a better environment in the region where they can continue to pursue this. They're the largest trading partner for the Arab Gulf. So I think they will have and should have more and more of a role. That's why I threw the ball back into the Soviet Union, into the Security Council. The Russia is not the Soviet Union, but as a member of the Council, it can play a role. But frankly, I don't believe that America alone is useful, but I don't think that the permanent five without America works.
That is a perfect way to end this conversation, because the U.S. has to be there, in an engaged way, can't do it by itself. This is not the era of Dr. Kissinger pushing Russians out and creating a new architecture. This is a new space, and it's going to either be, not either, it's got to be an architecture created by the people in the region with all the support that you've described. Let's hope there's movement in the directions you've outlined, Nabil, because right now we're stuck in the mud, and that would end badly unless you're, I don't know if you're an optimist or a realist, but you're hopeful. And you said at the start, if hope disappears, then we really have a problem.
So I don't want to shock you, but I'm not even hopeful. I'm just determined, because I know the consequences of not trying will really be very, very difficult.
When I introduced you, I said you know more about this region and the negotiations and the history than I suspect anybody still fighting the good fight. So thank you for all of that. And yes, I think determined is what needs, what is necessary at this point. Thank you very much, Nabil.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.